At the time of its construction, the rail bridge over the Missouri was a technological marvel. Today, the bridge remains as one of the most important architectural landmarks of our region. As the current bridge has been in service for over 100 years, BNSF wishes to construct a new bridge to accommodate the demands of the modern era. However, the preferred plan includes eventual removal of the existing historic bridge. Because of its historic significance, our community is afforded a chance to weigh in before a final decision is made. The following program recounts the history and preservation of the Bismarck-Mandan Rail Bridge. It was recorded in the studios of Dakota Media Access.
The Bismarck-Mandan Rail Bridge, it's kind of like any good North Dakotan. You know, it just does its job, it puts up with the weather, you hardly even notice it. But like a lot of good North Dakotans, sometimes we miss what its real significance is. And I think once you really understand the Bismarck-Mandan Rail Bridge, what it means, it's kind of awe-inspiring. Hi, I'm Rob Hanna, and I'm a historic interpreter who's worked at several different locations in North Dakota over the last decade or so.
My name is Emily Sackerson. I work in the field of historic preservation as an architectural historian here in Bismarck, and I also serve as the Vice President of Preservation North Dakota, which is a statewide nonprofit that supports grassroots preservation projects. And I'm here today speaking in favor of finding an alternative to the proposed demolition of the existing BNSF railroad bridge.
Just consider that this bridge is one of the oldest structures in North Dakota, one of the oldest structures of any kind, and yet it can still support 1,000-ton freight trains.
The discipline of historic preservation is often misunderstood. It doesn't seek simply to save old buildings. Rather, preservation is a multidisciplinary approach to planning, and it strives to create engaging opportunities for meaningful experiences. Historic preservation invites individuals to explore the history and heritage of an area, making use of the past to strengthen and develop a sense of place. It's a discipline that, in a lot of ways, is born out of conflict and controversy. It's often something that we think of as a reaction to development. In the 1960s, when federally initiated urban renewal and construction of the interstate highway system bulldozed entire neighborhoods, people across the country felt robbed of their heritage. They'd lost important, tangible connections to time, place, culture, and their identity, and their voices of concern hadn't been heard.
There's no system. They build the roads wherever they feel like it.
They never give one thought about marring the natural beauty of the land.
And so as a direct response, Congress passed the National Historic Preservation Act to ensure that all federal agencies would take into account the effects of their actions on historic properties, places that are important in our history and are important ways that we experience the past. And Section 106 of this act defines how federal agencies are supposed to meet that statutory responsibility. First, a federal agency is required to identify what properties in their project area are listed or eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. And those that are, they're defined as historic properties, must be considered in project planning. So they must determine how those properties might be affected by the proposed project. Next, they have to explore measures that would allow them to either avoid, minimize, or mitigate that adverse effect or that harm to those properties. And finally, through consultation with state historic preservation offices, tribal historic preservation offices, the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, and any stakeholders, any interested parties and members of the public, they have to reach an agreement that resolves that adverse effect. And so a federal undertaking, which is subject to this regulation, is really any project or activity that's funded or permitted or licensed or approved by a federal agency. And in initiating this process, their first step is determine if it's an undertaking and then identify those stakeholders and plan for public input. In January of 2018, BNSF announced their plans to replace the historic railroad crossing between Bismarck and Mandan with a new bridge that could better accommodate the changing rail needs, their changing uses. And because this action involves a navigable waterway, which is the Missouri River, it requires a permit from the U.S. Coast Guard. And so it's determined to be a federal undertaking. And the Coast Guard is the lead federal agency on this project, responsible for complying with the National Historic Preservation Act and subsequent laws. And they'll ultimately have the final word on the project. And BNSF has presented to the public three preferred alternatives for the projected plans and to gauge public interest and public input. Alternative one that they provided is highlighted in our map in yellow, and that's a no-action plan, which maintains the existing structure. Alternative two, which is outlined in red, consists of a new bridge on a new alignment 80 feet north of the existing structure with 200-foot spans and two new piers that are aligned with the existing bridge, and the bridge remains. The third alternative is a new bridge on a new alignment 30 feet north of the existing bridge, also with 200-foot spans, but new piers staggered relative to the existing piers of the existing bridge, and the existing bridge would be demolished. And that plan is the alternative shown in green on our maps. That's BNSF's preferred alternative. So along with early public involvement and within the regulatory process, it requires that the federal agency identifies whether any historic properties are in the project area need to be considered. And how do they decide that? Well, they typically hire a consulting firm to do a survey. They go into the project area and record any cultural resources that are present, and they make their management recommendations based on the National Register of Historic Places criteria for evaluation. And the National Register was created in the same National Historic Preservation Act in the 60s. We have a handful of properties in Bismarck and Mandan that are on the National Register, and it's a great thing. Each of these sites, they really ground us in our history and our heritage, and the celebration of our built environment has lots of proven benefits. There's educational benefits, recreational, and it stimulates the economy. So while most people think of the National Register only as a designation of important places or an avenue for federal funding to rehab a property, its most important role, I argue, is as a planning tool. It's the measure by which we determine if a cultural resource, such as the bridge, a landscape, an archaeological site, is historically significant and warrants this kind of consideration in a federal undertaking. So if it qualifies, a property is guaranteed consideration in federal undertakings, regardless of its ownership. And our rail bridge spanning the Missouri was recorded and evaluated, and it was found to be eligible for listing in the National Register. And not only is it eligible, but it's eligible under three of the four criteria for evaluation, and at a national scale rather than a local or statewide level. And as stated in the surveyor's report, it remains the oldest standing bridge in North Dakota and one of the most iconic structures within the Bismarck-Mandan metropolitan area. And the proposed demolition of the historic rail bridge under BNSF's preferred alternative, that alternative three, constitutes an adverse effect to the historic property and requires consultation under the 106 process. And that's ongoing. So consulting parties play a key role by providing input regarding the effects to the project that the project might have on historic properties, since they know them best, and assisting in the development of appropriate mitigation measures that might resolve those adverse effects. During the initial public meeting over a year ago, what BNSF and the federal agency did was to initiate their public outreach, and they began to identify the consulting parties that would need to weigh in on the future of the bridge. Keeping in mind that the purpose of this process is to ensure that the federal agency involved has considered all options to avoid, minimize, or mitigate an adverse effect to a historic property. The list of consulting parties for this project has evolved in the course of almost a year to include something like 46 different groups. They've met many times, and they bring credible, interesting, provocative questions and ideas and concerns to the table, all of which is to ensure that the federal agency is taking the steps needed to build the information necessary to do right by the community and this historically significant resource, an irreplaceable place that matters to us.
A long time before anybody talked about tearing down this bridge, I remember walking underneath it with my wife. We were going along the river, and we just stopped underneath it. We're just kind of drinking in what an amazing sight it was. And I remember saying to her, you know, I can't believe there's not even a sign here. You know, this is the link that ties two oceans together and help bring several states into existence. And there's not even a sign. It's just standing there doing its job. Even though the bridge is an important achievement, it's important to remember that it's not an equally positive achievement for everyone. The bridge stands where the Nuwata or Mandan people crossed Manta, the river. It was their crossing. And for the Dakotas and Lakotas, this is where they crossed Minnishosha. Yeah, almost in that same spot where the bridge stands now. when the government of the United States tried to take control of this region from these native tribes, they didn't just do it using soldiers like Custer, you know, who might be the first person you think of. They also used infrastructure like the Northern Pacific Railroad with the bridge. In fact, Custer helped build the railroad that this bridge was a part of. Before the bridge, Dakota Territory was kind of a transportation dead end. You know, you had tracks stretching east and west, but there's this 3,000-foot gap at the Missouri River. And for years, the railroad just had to ferry freight over the river. They'd actually ferry trains, a few cars at a time. Eventually, Thomas Rosser, he's an engineer for the railroad and an ex-Confederate general, was actually friends of George Armstrong Custer's, Thomas Rosser. He figured out that during the coldest months of the year, when the river's frozen solid over, he could lay tracks across the river. I believe he used kind of like extra large tracks so that it would spread out the weight of the trains. And that was awesome. So he had this ice bridge. It actually became national news. They images of it were featured around the country. But for a few months, from about January to March, in 1879, in the very early 1880s, you could run trains right over the river, and this was just considered awesome. You know, they wanted this bridge. George Shattuck Morrison is the man who is tasked with figuring out how to build this bridge. He's a self-trained engineer, and he really had his work cut out for him. You know, the Missouri River is one of the largest rivers in the world. In Bismarck, it's not as wide as it is downstream. Actually, the bridge is one of the reasons why. We'll come to that. But one of the big issues is that the river has these incredible ice jams, right? We get severe winters up here, and the Missouri River has the Yellowstone River and the Little Missouri River flowing into it from the south. So they thaw out first, water comes up and starts pushing on the ice ahead of it, and you start getting these massive ice dams. Even here in the spring of 2019, we saw these giant ice dams on the Little Missouri and Yellowstone rivers. And these could explode with a bunch of force. It was considered that the Missouri River in the springtime could destroy basically anything in its path. And George Shattuck Morrison had to build a bridge in the middle of that. He also had to figure out how to make the bridge tall enough that steamboats could pass underneath. There was a very busy steamboat trade on the river, and so he had to build 400-foot bridge spans, and as well as give the bridge enough height that even at high watermark, steamboats would be able to pass underneath. It would have been a rather spectacular bridge at the time because it had to span this big river and accommodate large boats underneath, and that's why early on, they referred to it as the High Bridge, or the Missouri High Bridge. Well, the first thing the railroad had to do was to narrow the river by about two-thirds. It went from about 3,000 to about 1,000 feet wide. And the way they did that, on the Mandan side of the river, they had contractors gather over 60 million pounds of brush bundles, logs, sandbags, stones, and they built a dike out into the water from the Mandan side of the river, again, two-thirds out into the middle of the river. And the idea was then every year as the water came up, sediment is being washed down the river, it would pile up on the other side and start building up new land. It's actually now called Captain's Landing Township. I think most people who live in Bismarck, Mandan today don't even realize it, but that whole neighborhood is on land that was built for the bridge. But this narrows the river so that you don't have to build as big of a bridge. The other thing that they did, another thing I think a lot of residents in this area don't know about, is was a wooden train trestle that would run from the Mandan side out across this newly formed land up to the bridge. And today, it just looks like really steep ground. They've packed the sides with clay. It's all covered in grass now, but that's actually the wooden train trestle that they built from the high ground on Mandan to the bridge. George Morrison also designed four stone piers. Two would be in the water in the now narrower river, and two were going to be on land. I want you to think about this. Using the technology that you would have available to you in 1881 when he got started, how would you build two massive stone piers in the middle of a major river? Well, here's how he did it. First, he had some wooden, they're wooden rooms. They're 74 by 25 foot wooden rooms called caissons. And he moved them to the spot where he wanted them to be in the river, sank them to the bottom, Had the wooden floors removed, and the edges of it, you want to imagine, are kind of coming at a sharp angle, and they're pushing into the sand, you know, once you take the floor out. Then he's got steam engines that pressurize the air so that water won't flow into the rooms with the floors gone. He sends his workers down into the caissons, and they have essentially steam-powered vacuum cleaners that suck up the sand. So they're sucking the sand up out of the caisson and dumping it somewhere else, you know, nearby. And those sharp edges of the caissons allow it to sort of sink into the sand as they go. Now, meanwhile, on top of the caisson, other workers are putting down bricks. These are the ones that you see, these massive stone blocks that they would get from quarries out in Minnesota and build those up. And it's kind of tricky to do because what it's doing, it's forcing the caisson down as they're also sucking away sand and lowering it. They have to sort of make adjustments as they go to keep it straight. But eventually the caisson with its sharp edges push all the way down to the bedrock at the bottom of the river. That's how they build it. The other thing that they have to do, you imagine the pressure down in that caisson room, they had to build airlocks. I didn't even realize that airlocks existed in 1881, but you would literally, to leave the caisson, have to climb up a tunnel, go into a little room, close one door, open another, climb out the rest, so that you could escape that space while still keeping the pressure down below. Of the two caissons, the one on the east side, the deeper one, bottomed out at 46 feet below the bottom of the riverbed. The north upstream edge of each caisson is pointed, and it's got that metal plate that you still see there. And that was his innovation to cut through the ice jams. And they obviously worked. It's been 137 winters, including this one, and it's cut the ice away and done its job just fine. Now, to build the spans of the bridge, they had to build wooden cribbing. It would have also looked like a trestle down into the water between all of the piers, and that would allow them to build the surface of these new trusses. The shape that he used was called Warren trusses. They're not the trusses you see now. In 1909, as larger trains were being used, they needed something that could support even more weight, and so now you see these arch-shaped trusses that we're familiar with. One of the other things that was really high-tech and ahead of its time, he didn't just use iron trusses, he made them partially out of steel, which of course is more strong and flexible. It's interesting to think about what this bridge would have looked like to people then. You know, now we have this kind of romantic association with a truss bridge like that. But in that day, it was very industrial. Like, they were proud of it. They were very impressed. It was big. It was high tech. But it wasn't necessarily beautiful. It was actually several years after the bridge was finished that the Eiffel Tower in France was built. And this is the first time that steel, and in that case, iron trusses, are used to make an artwork. And it was actually very controversial. Nobody had ever thought to use trusses to make an artwork. So they tested the bridge on October 21st, 1882. And what they did is they parked 8 locomotives. The locomotives would be heavier than the train cars. It's the heaviest thing they could put on each bridge span. They park 8 locomotives on each span, move to the next one, move to the next one, and measure whether the bottom of the span bowed at all. And It was enough that they thought that it was very safe. The very same day as the test, they had planned a celebration. I think they were optimistic it was going to work. And they had the most perfect way to celebrate a bridge that I can imagine. They had a party that started on one side and finished on the other. It began over in Mandan at the Interocean Hotel. It's where the Lewis and Clark Hotel building stands now. And had a lunch with champagne. Then they got on a train and rode across the bridge to the Sheridan House in Bismarck. And that's where the depot building, the historic depot building in Bismarck, is today. And that party was sort of the evening banquet. And it must have been, according to the newspapers, it was the most elaborate banquet that Dakota Territory had ever seen. They built a 13-foot miniature bridge out of evergreen boughs and flowers. The Bismarck Tribune is quoted as saying the banquet was the most notable in the life of the territory. Well, the bridge is important because it's one of the last and one of the most challenging pieces of the Northern Pacific Railroad to be constructed. It was finished in October 1882, and the railroad was finished out in Montana a little less than a year later, like 11 months later in September of 1883. The Northern Pacific Railroad was going to extend from the Great Lakes and St. Paul in Minnesota to the Puget Sound out on the Pacific coast. And It was a central part of American expansionism. We forget this now, but American expansionism created a lot of controversy, especially before the Civil War. Every time a new state was going to come into the Union, there was this big fight over whether it was going to be a state where slavery was legal or not. But when the Civil War started, of course, most of the states that supported slavery had left Congress. And so the only people left were Republicans and other Northerners who were against slavery. And they didn't just try to admit new free Republican states. They actually aggressively set up laws that would guarantee that new states for decades to come would be free pro-Republican states. The Homestead Act is a part of that. Americans, and most importantly, immigrants from other countries, could move here, acquire a home, and start a living, and those immigrants could become potential recruits for the Republican Party. The transcontinental railroads are part of that, too. The first transcontinental railroad is the Union and Central Pacific Railroad that you always hear about. But the second was the Northern Pacific Railroad that we've been talking about today. Their attempts, all of this, their attempts to create new territories and create new states very quickly. Because once you've got rails, now you can ship goods, you can transport settlers, they can set up farms and homesteads, and in no time you've expanded the country and you've created new states where slavery will never be legal and where the Republican Party can prevail. In fact, the Republican Party slogan during those years was, "Free soil, free labor, free men." Now, the Northern Pacific was such a massive undertaking that when the bank that was funding it, the Jay Cook Bank, went bankrupt, it set off an international economic depression. They called it the Panic of 1873. In fact, if somebody said the Great Depression prior to the 1930s, they were referring to the Panic of 1873 that started when that railroad went bankrupt. And by the way, that railroad had been built right up to Bismarck at that point. They didn't make it yet to the west side and build any tracks when they went bankrupt. It's funny because I studied economic history at a university in Germany, and I remember sitting on the ninth floor of this tower block in class listening to one of my professors who started talking about the Panic of 1873, how it had started in the United States and spread to Europe. And I had to smile because he had all but mentioned my hometown. He's probably never heard of Bismarck and Mandan, North Dakota, but he had all but mentioned my hometown because I knew that when he talked about the Panic of 1873, that was set off right here at the end of the Northern Pacific Railroad in Bismarck, North Dakota. It took some time for the railroad to regain a solid financial footing, but when they did, it made a huge impact on Dakota Territory. North Dakota, as we know it, was without a doubt created by this and maybe the later Great Northern Railroad that comes just a few years afterwards. Historians talk about the first Dakota boom, and it's not a coincidence that that happened right after the rail bridge was completed. North Dakota was transformed from a dead end, you know, this rail line that runs up to the Missouri River and then just stops. Then you do have a second line that goes out to Montana, but with a gap in between, right? But the bridge and the completion of the entire railroad 11 months later transforms North Dakota from this dead end into part of a global transportation route, right? Atlantic Ocean, North America, Pacific Ocean, now you're part of the system. Again, we take this bridge for granted. We forget what it means. But when you think about North Dakota history, you're surprised when you start to notice that all kinds of really influential events, events you've heard about many times, they all happened within about 2 years of the completion of the rail bridge, or about 1 year within the completion of the railroad. I mean, that's how significant the railroad was. We're talking 1883 and 1884. Just in those 2 years, the University of North Dakota was founded, Jamestown College, now Jamestown University, were founded. The state hospital, the state penitentiary were established. Theodore Roosevelt moved to the Badlands, traveling over the bridge, by the way, to get there. He bought the Maltese and Cross and Elkhorn ranches those years. The Marquis de Morays moved out here in 1883-4. He started his beef butchering business. The territorial capital moved from Yankton in the southern part of the territory up to Bismarck. By the way, the railroad wanted that move. They wanted the capital of the territory to move to a spot on their railroad route. What else? I remember being surprised, but not that surprised, when I realized how many state historic sites were built between 1883 and 1884. Stutzman County Courthouse in Jamestown, the former governor's mansion in Bismarck, the Chateau de Morais in Medora, all built during those 2 years. But many of the construction materials that were needed to build these were shipped on the railroad. The first dude ranch in the United States was established near Medora, again, with customers arriving by train in 1883. There were 29 towns established during those years, Belfield, Glen Olen, Medora, New Salem, Richardton, and that's just naming the ones that are along the direct route of the railroad. There are other ones in other parts of the territory. The bridge, I don't want to say the bridge caused all of those things directly, but the railroad relied on the bridge, and the bridge completed the railroad. That's what made all this possible. Just picture almost anything from that time period west of the Missouri River. The materials that made buildings and towns, the farm implements, furnishings, the books, the toys, the people, maybe even your own ancestors, they all probably crossed this bridge. The bridge is the tangible symbol of the Northern Pacific Railroad, the engineering achievement, the impact on the land, and the creation of North Dakota. It's the visible thing we can point to when we tell our kids about this monumental construction project and everything it changed for a region of the United States. It's not just important, it's part of our identity. It's part of what makes us who we are.
My name is Mandy Pearson, and I'm the Secretary of Friends of the Rail Bridge. And Friends of the Rail Bridge needs your help to preserve our historic 1883 rail bridge and turn it into a community recreation resource. We are a nonprofit registered with the state of North Dakota, and our mission is bridging community through history, education, and recreation. Our board of 11 members has been hard at work for the past year attending 106 consulting party meetings and investigating the possibility of repurposing the bridge for pedestrian use. We are also researching how other historic bridges from around the country have been converted to pedestrian trails. We are learning from their methods and brainstorming ways that we can create the same success in our own city. We spend a fair amount of time grant writing, which we are proud to say has led to the funding of a feasibility study. This study has been ongoing since December and provides important groundwork outlining what is necessary for a successful project from start to finish. In order to accomplish our mission, Friends of the Rail Bridge needs partners at the local, state, and national level. We see this bridge as a path that leads us back to our past, our roots, and the many sacrifices of all people who inhabited the Great Northern Plains before us. We also see this bridge as a path to the future, exploring the possibilities of what it means to have a more connected community, bridged by history, education, and recreation. Historic preservation is not only about saving old structures. It creates something new, an experience, a place that gives context and connects us to the stories of our past. John Sahill said, "In the end, our society will be defined not only by what they create, but by what they refuse to destroy." He was the CEO of the Nature Conservancy for a decade, and he was onto something that applies to nature, open spaces, and historic spaces. We can take Bismarck, which is a good city, and systematically make choices that turn it into a great city. The rail bridge is one of those choices. So if this message resonates with you as a corporation, a Bismarck resident, a North Dakota citizen, or even as you watch from across the country, I would urge you to join our efforts in preserving this historic rail bridge. You can visit our website at friendsoftherailbridge.org to learn more about the bridge and our mission. You can become a friend of the rail bridge by making a financial gift. You can also contact your city and state leaders. If you don't know what to say, you can use the template found on our website and adjust to your liking. But whatever you do, let someone know that this bridge matters to you.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of Dakota Media Access. To watch a video of this program, visit freetv.org and search for Bisman Rail Bridge.